past you look so strong. Then you fade away. The sun will blind my eyes. I want you anyway. Thirsty for your smile. I want you for a while. You are a vapor trail in a deep blue sky.
Good afternoon. You've got the Living Writers Show here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And I'm Amanda Yulee, your summer host. We're taping a show here June 6th, 2019. We're so happy to have Christina Henriquez here in the studio with us. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Glad you're here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Christina, I think I'll read your bio to sort of start us off and orient everyone to who you are. Christina Henriquez is author of The Book of Unknown Americans, which we'll be focusing on in our conversation today. She's also the author of the story collection Come Together, Fall Apart, which was a New York Times Editor's Choice selection, and the novel The World in Half. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The American Scholar, Glimmer Train, Virginia Quarterly, Plowshares, and others, as well as various anthologies. And she lives in Illinois. In the Midwest, like us.
That's right.
Thanks for coming in today to speak with us.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
And this is not your first time in Michigan.
No, I've been to various parts of Michigan. I've been to Ann Arbor, actually, before, and it's really nice to be back. It's a beautiful day today.
It's a summer day.
Yeah,
in Ann Arbor,
so
which is
really
a great
nice
thing.
To be walking around outside and just, you know, see all the people and all the shops and everything. Yeah. I've been to Holland, Michigan. I've been to Detroit, basically. Yeah.
We connected over some
yes.
Detroit years ago times that we may have been in the same room for before we knew one another.
Which is really weird. Yeah.
Which is super weird, yeah. But terrific
yes.
in its own way.
Yeah.
So I wanted to mention, before we sort of get into talking about the books and the Book of Unknown Americans in particular, I wanted to mention the other reason that you were here in Ann Arbor. Before you were the Washtenaw County Reads selection.
That's correct.
Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads.
Yes.
Tell us about that, if you will.
Yeah, that was exciting. That happened a few years ago, shortly after the Book of Unknown Americans had come out. And I was just starting to get sometimes this interest from different towns or communities who are doing their sort of, you know, all community read selections. So that was one of the earlier ones that I had done. And I came and, you know, got to talk in front of this great audience. And it was a lot of fun. And it's always cool to do those things because, you know, it's one of those events that, like, everybody can come together around a book. And it creates this kind of community that, and I don't know if people actually even see it that way. You know, they call it community reads, but then you go and you're sitting in an auditorium with this common experience that you've had with all of these other people who are otherwise strangers in a room. And I think that's a really kind of a cool thing to be a part of.
Beautiful
yeah.
and rare.
Yeah.
What's that like as a writer? Because writing is such a solitary affair.
It is. Yeah. You're sort of hiding away in a cave, right? For like a certain number of years.
Some amount of time,
yeah.
depending on how long it takes you.
Right. And you're just basically hanging out with imaginary people for that duration. And then you kind of emerge from the cave and you go and you see all of these people, which is great. And it's really heartening, A, to be reminded how much books in general do mean to people and can mean to people. But then, you know, occasionally there'll be the person who you can tell your book really touched them or they really connected with it in some way. And they'll come up to you at the signing table or something. And, you know, they're like very nervous and almost sort of flustered to talk to you. But it's because like they're so kind of overcome by that experience of reading your book. And that's just a really humbling kind of thing.
Well, that's kind of a moment, I would think, in any author's life that is this confluence of all the solitary time that you've spent and then the solitary time that your reader has spent
right.
in their head with
right.
your book.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, one of the questions I get asked quite a bit, you know, they tend to repeat from place to place. And one that I get asked a lot is whether the characters in my book were based on anybody I know mm-hmm. in real life, which I guess is just a different version of asking me, is the book based on real life or my life? And I always answer no. And then there's this weird palpable disappointment, you know, I can like people kind of sit back and like, oh, like their shoulders kind of droop. They're like, they wanted me to say yes. And I was trying forever to figure out what that was about. And I have like a few theories, but one of them has to do with what you just said, which is I think that people spend a certain amount of time reading a book. And they, if the book is good, they feel really connected to those characters, you know, and that storyline. And I think when they ask that question, what they're really asking is they're saying, hey, I just spent all this time connecting to these characters. And what I want to know is, did I actually just connect to you?
Yes.
And I think that then when you answer no, the book, you know, they're all invented. It was all just a product of my imagination. Of course, there's a sense of disappointment then that goes along with that, right? Where you feel like, you know, I mean, because that's a human thing. You want to connect with other people. So,
but they have made that connection.
They have.
With your imagination.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Which is, you know, an inextricable part of me. So,
of course. Yeah. That's interesting. I want to talk more about your readers and how they have interfaced with your books in a bit. But first, I think for our listeners who have not read The Book of Unknown Americans, it would be great to have you sort of introduce it for us.
I will do my best. I think this is one of the hardest questions to ask a writer.
Is that
like,
right?
Describe your own work. It's like, I don't actually know what I did. So this book, first of all, was inspired by my dad. And my dad is an immigrant who came to the United States when he was 18 years old, I think. And he came to go to college. And he was going to go to the University of Delaware, where he was going to study chemical engineering. And he thought, you know, he would come for 4 years and then he would get his degree and he would go back to Panama, which is where his family all was and still is to this day. But while he was here, he ended up meeting my mom and he stayed here because of her. And he's been here ever since. So, you know, he's been here for more than 40 years. And I grew up seeing firsthand kind of what it was like for him being an immigrant in the United States. And I had seen that on the one hand. And on the other hand, I had just gotten to an age where I was actually sort of paying attention to the news more and more interested in, you know, the world around me. And I was hearing all the rhetoric that even predates now mm-hmm. about immigrants.
Years ago.
Yeah. This was on the heels of 9/11, actually, mm-hmm. when that kind of really divisive, really negative language started cropping up of like the us versus them mentality, who was desirable, who was not, who should be let in, who should be kept out. And I felt like, you know, here was my dad on the one hand, and I had a certain experience and a certain idea of him and his life. And on the other hand, here was all these things I was hearing in the news, and those two things didn't seem compatible to me. And it just became very clear that we weren't telling the whole story, right? That we were only talking about one certain kind of angle. And I thought, well, I want to tell a different kind of story about immigrants. And I guess so I had that kind of in my head, but you know, a book never really takes off for me until I can find the language for it. So I had this vague idea. I want to write a book about immigrants. So that's kind of the short answer of what the book is about. But it ended up really plot-wise being about these two families. One is the Rivera family, who is coming from Mexico, and they're coming because their daughter, who's 15 years old, her name is Maribel, she has suffered a traumatic brain injury the year before they came. And they come to the United States, and they come to Delaware in particular, to get her the kind of education and medical care that she needs. They end up moving into this building that has all of these other people from Latin America. And one of those families is the Toro family. And they have come from Panama. years and years ago. And their son, Mayor, who is 16, ends up seeing Maribel. And then he just sort of falls for her right away. And so on the one level, it's sort of this teenage love story between these two kids. It's also the ways that these families kind of their, I don't know, their fates kind of intertwine throughout the course of the book. And then the other thing, the other sort of component to it is that all of the neighbors who live in the apartment building with them all get a chance at some point during the course of the novel to tell their story of coming to the United States. And that sort of became the spirit of the book for me at a certain point. You know, there's the plot and then there's the spirit of it. And that, I think, you know, that was the heart of the thing.
Well, it's kind of an incredible feat. As a reader, I took it as, I found it really amazing how you inhabited each of those personalities to tell a story. How can you talk about the structure of the book a little
bit,
actually?
Yeah, so the structure is, so the two narrators are Mayor Toro, the 16-year-old boy who I mentioned, and then on the other side, the other narrator is Maribel's mother, whose name is Alma, and it just goes back and forth between them, mostly, except that every once in a while they're interrupted by one of those neighbors who live in the building, and then so for about two or three pages you hear from that person, which is sort of a tricky way to put together a book, and it didn't always exist in the form that it does now, but you know, it just follows them through, I don't know, some choices that different people make, a nosy neighbor who sets into motion a whole sort of plot thing that has terrible consequences for everybody, pretty much, but especially for the Riveras. And then, you know, ends on a note that I think is, it is bleak in a certain way, but it's also hopefully a little bit hopeful. And interestingly, when I go around and do talks, usually when I'm talking to students, they want a sequel, which is always a funny thing too.
What a compliment.
So,
right?
Yeah, but I mean, I felt like it took me 5 years to write it, and I felt like, oh, like I really spent enough time with these people and I was ready to be done and say goodbye. But it's funny to me that they want it to go on and on. So, yeah.
So the book is told, I think I'm correct, everything is in first person.
Everything's first person.
So tell us about that.
Yes. So in total, there's 11 narrators, all in first person. And I felt like that was a no-brainer. It always had to be first person. If you're going to write a book where what you're doing is centering these stories of these people and their voices, like letting their voices be on the page, then it had to be them telling their own stories, right? The challenge of that, of course, is making 11 different narrators sound like themselves and be differentiated enough that you would, you know, feel that they were all separate kind of characters. I originally had 22 narrators.
Oh my. That's twice as many.
Yeah. Which was a little bit crazy. And I pared that back eventually. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's this book that no one has heard of. Maybe you have because you're very well read. There's this book called Gig. It was sort of a follow-up to Studs Terkel's Working. And so I think Word.com published it like a while ago, like years and years
ago. I don't know it.
Yeah. So it's basically people at their workplaces just talking about their jobs.
Their workplaces.
Yeah. So it's like a UPS worker or like a Walmart greeter or a lawyer, you know, it just sort of runs the gamut. Yes.
Yeah.
And that I loved that book at a certain time in my life. And I think that idea of these like very short kind of oral histories crept into my psyche in some way. And so that was sort of the device that I was using to get all of these voices across in the novel.
And yet you're separating those 11 perspectives because we have people who are who come at these, at the plot events from very different emotional perspectives.
Yeah.
Very different.
Well, and part of the mission of the book became, you know, including as many different kinds of voices as I could. Mm-hmm. Right? So they had to feel like that. And some of them have nothing to do with the plot. They're just kind of hanging out there in the middle of the book. And I had to trust that that was going to be okay with readers.
Yeah. I think it adds to it.
Yeah, but it was scary, you know? It's like, yeah. Can you just throw something in that has nothing to do with anything else? It's just, you're just asking someone to go with it for 3 pages and then...
But that's what life is, right? Like in real life, you have these extraneous things that are part of the whole.
Yes.
Whether or not you planned them.
Yes.
Or whether or not they fit in.
Yeah. 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 And so in the end, I went with it and, you know.
Yeah. In all those different narrators in the book, do you feel like there was something that they have in common, even though they're coming at this in a different way?
Yeah, sure. There's a lots of things. I mean, I think what I really tried to see as their commonality, and this sounds so basic, but was that they're just human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, they're from lots of different countries. They have all different reasons for having come to the United States, for having left their life behind. I mean, that's the other commonality, of course. And they become each other's family on the basis of that, partly. But I was trying to juggle two things at the same time, which was one, I wanted to differentiate them all. And the other thing, which seemed completely antithetical in a certain way, was that I needed them all to just to seem like the same in the sense that they were all just people.
Just people.
Right? Which is interesting how radical of a notion that is, especially in the middle of, like, you know, in the midst of today's kinds of discussions about immigrants. That they would be people. I used to say about this novel that it was a book about all of these immigrants who lived in an apartment building together. And now I try to correct myself and say it's a book about all of these people.
Yes.
You know, I think it's an important distinction.
I think it's very important. Yes, for sure. Yeah, I think that, you know, all the characters in some way, reflecting back to your title of the book, they're sort of grappling with being American in some ways. Was that intentional? And can you speak to that a little bit?
I think just in the sense of how anybody who comes to a new place is always trying to feel that sense of belonging and trying to claim that, right? I mean, again, back to my dad who's been here for, you know, decades, I think he feels really solidly that the United States is his home now. Mm-hmm. But in certain ways, I think he still isn't sure that it wants him, you know, that he...
After all this time.
Yeah, has... I don't know, you know, if he fully feels that sense of belonging all the time. So in that way, yeah, I think that they're, you know, trying to figure out... I wanted to give them that word in the title, Americans. I felt like that was important. You know, but I do think that most of the characters would claim it for themselves and would say that they felt that they were American.
But their emotions are complicated. I mean, in some cases, people are longing for the country they came from. They're longing for a better situation in America where they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's complicated. We're speaking to Christina Henriquez, who's author of The Book of Unknown Americans and others. And it is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, The Living Writer Show. I think we will take a break. And I'm so glad that you chose The Wedding Present for one of the songs.
I feel like, I mean, I didn't know this in advance, but you may be the only other person who would have recognized or known The Wedding Present selection.
I love The Wedding. So. I've seen The Wedding Present many times. And, yeah. This is great news that we can play The Wedding Present.
I know. That's classic.
Let's hear The Wedding Present, and then we'll talk again to Christina Henriquez.
Thank you.
is the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And I'm Amanda Yulee, your host today, for a chat with Christina Henriquez. The question that was popping into my mind on the last break is the Wedding Present still making records? Do you know if they are?
I don't know, actually.
I don't either.
I'm not sure. I have, I don't know, approximately 6 or 7 of their albums, but I don't know recently what they're up to.
Yeah. Yeah. And what, maybe you want to speak to why you chose that song for today.
You know, in preparation for this show, you had mentioned that, you know, I should give you some songs. And you also mentioned something like, what are songs that make you feel like a teenager? Mm-hmm. And so immediately when you said that, my head went to like Wedding Present and a few other bands mm-hmm. who I had been listening to in high school. You know, I was just a very like typical kind of emo girl who would like lay on my floor and mm-hmm. turn off all the lights and was like, you know, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I was sort of getting into kind of, I guess then we were calling it alternative music. It's funny to go back and like to hear that and to still remember the words is funny too.
It's an interesting trick of memory. Uh-huh. And, your characters, the main characters in the Book of Unknown Americans, are teenagers who are beginning a relationship or who are interested in one another.
That's right.
How much of your own teenage experience went into building those characters?
I mean,
their emotions.
Not a lot, not in the sense of like that this mirrored any relationship I had had or anything like that. But, you know, those feelings.
The intensity of them.
Yeah. I mean, for some reason, for me, they're easy to access still. You know, like I can get to that place pretty quickly. And I used to keep journals and stuff. And so if I listen to music or if I look at my old journals, you know, it takes me back to that place like readily. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I tried to funnel that kind of feeling into Mayor and Maribel, and what they were going through. And I love Mayor. I mean, I think he's a sweet, sweet boy. If I'd had a boyfriend like that in high school, you know, I wouldn't have complained about Mayor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Those feelings are, I mean, I actually think it makes the book one that is, I think, accessible to a younger audience. I assume mostly adults are reading this book. But...
Well, I had intended it for adults. You know, like I thought, oh, I'm writing an adult literary fiction novel. And it's been interesting to me, actually, to see how it's been picked up at universities and at high schools, and how much the students love it. Like, they'll come in and they'll say, you know, oh, we always get assigned books to read, and I always hate doing the reading for class, but this is the first book that I ever really loved. And it's like, wow, like that's really cool. And I think it's nice too. What I've also seen is that kids read it with their parents, which mm-hmm. is interesting. But again, I think that's because one of the narrators is a 16-year-old boy. So the kids are into that storyline, right? And then the other narrator is a parent who's trying to make these choices and do all of these things for her daughter and for the sake of her daughter and her well-being. And so the parents get that side of it. And then they can both read it together and kind of bond about the book, which is...
Well, there's some empathy on both sides.
Yeah.
Which is very challenging. It can be very challenging for
It's been nice
teenagers.
To see, but again, it's like I didn't anticipate it. I didn't plan it that way, you know, or think about it in that way as I was writing it, so...
I'd love to know more about how your readers have responded. It sounds like you were surprised by the different ages that have connected to the book. Has anything else surprised you?
I've just been generally surprised at how positive the reception has been. You know, I actually was somewhat anxious. It's easy to forget now, but when I think back on it, I was a little bit anxious to publish the book. Not that it was going to... I didn't think I had said anything like inflammatory or controversial, mm-hmm. although... You know, almost anything can be, I suppose. But I felt that there were certain people who were just not going to like it no matter what. And who more than that, like, were going to, I don't know, berate me for it or, you know, somehow sort of drag me over the coals about it. And that has not been the case at all.
No.
It's been quite the opposite.
It's been very well received.
So that's been really nice to see and really heartening to see.
Why do you think that you felt that way? Is it because of the way our country has received immigrants?
Yeah. And again, I think it was because I was so closely paying attention to like media and the way that we were talking about immigrants and immigration. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you know, it felt like a divisive issue. And I just felt like, oh, my gosh, am I getting in the middle of this thing that now, you know, people are going to be yelling at me or something. And again, it really hasn't been the case. It's been actually amazing to see. You know, I went, actually, it was in Ann Arbor.
Huh.
And I, after the event, I was in the doing the signing line, and a woman came up to me, and she said she loved the scene. There's a scene where Alma and Arturo put Maribel on the school bus for the first time to send her off to school. You know, and they don't know English. They don't know where she's going. You know, they just have to like put her on this bus and have faith that it's going to work out and it's going to take her to the right place and she's going to come back again and everything's going to be okay. And so it's really scary. I mean, it's scary enough just as a parent, you know, who doesn't have a lot of the challenges that they were facing on that day. So this woman said, that was my favorite scene in the book. And she said, what it did for her was it brought to mind a place near her, a school near her, that had a lot of immigrant children. And she called the school and she said, is there anything that I can do to help? And the school said to her, well, do you know Spanish or do you speak Spanish? And she said, no, but I speak mother. And I just thought that was so great. But I feel like I've seen that everywhere that I've gone, people who just really want to help and make this better for other people. And that's been
as a result of reading the book, or I mean, part of,
yeah, or it's, yeah, made them think about it at least. Yeah. And it's, I had a teacher who contacted me who said, you know, we read this book, in our class. And so then the students got all fired up about it. This was during the time, when there was a lot of discussion. The discussion was on the table, at least, about DACA and then about TPS. And the students were really fired up, and they decided sort of on their own, according to the teacher, to write letters to their congresspeople, to, you know, voice their frustrations, and their outrage about what was happening. And I just thought, you know, sometimes art, you can feel like, oh, I'm sitting by myself in this room with imaginary people, or it can feel sometimes like, am I just doing something indulgent? Should I be out in the world, like affecting more kind of direct
protesting,
you know, change?
And,
yeah, doing that kind of stuff.
Writing to your,
and then you get an email like that from a teacher, and you think, no, like, you know, that's the reason partly that art exists, right? Because it moves people.
I believe books can change the world. I mean, I always have. But it is sort of this grand generalized statement that you one wonders about.
Right. So that was like a concrete, you know, example of these students mm-hmm. who felt suddenly like empowered to change their world, to do something. And I just thought, oh, my gosh. I mean, that, you know, that was sort of a peak moment, I think, for me.
When you were speaking about your father before, living here for decades and not yet necessarily having that sense of belonging or security in that belonging forever. It made me wonder if you have a perspective on what we as a country, we as individuals should be doing to make that better. I mean, one answer is writing books and reading them.
Yeah. Well, certainly that is true. And the other answer is like the woman who called the school. It's like, mm-hmm. you have to figure out what is your power in the world, and then you have to use it, right? So she found a bridge. And I always exhort students when I go and do talks, I said, you know, she found the bridge. Find yours. Like, what is the thing that you do? Like, what is the strength that you have? If you're a good writer, can you, you know, call your congressperson and offer to, like, read press releases or write? Like, what can you actually do and bring to the world that's going to affect change? You know, because I think it's a big, overwhelming topic. And people in the face of that can sometimes feel like they can't do anything. And so they might as well not try. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's useful to think just in your individual life. What can you do? Because there's an accumulation of that, right? If everybody did that, think of how things could change.
Sure. We're speaking to Christina Henriquez on the Living Writer Show, and this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Our engineer today is Frank Yulee, who's doing a fine job across the glass. I think we'll hear a song, another song that you chose. Is it Superchunk? It is Superchunk. I was just looking at my notes here.
Oh, gosh.
Fantastic choice. And then, Christina, I hope that after the break, you'll read a bit from the Book of Unknown Americans.
Sure.
And we can continue our conversation. All right. Here's Superchunk. Superchunk on the Living Writer Show. We're speaking with Christina Henriquez today. Thanks for being here in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. I think we're going to have you read a bit from the Book of Unknown Americans, and maybe you can introduce it for us and tell us which narrator you're reading from to start with.
Absolutely. So this, I chose just a few pages from the very beginning of the book. And so the narrator here is Alma Rivera, who, again, has just, she and her husband and daughter are just arriving from Mexico. And this is that arrival. Back then, all we wanted was the simplest things: to eat good food, to sleep at night, to smile, to laugh, to be well. We felt it was our right, as much as it was anyone's, to have those things. Of course, when I think about it now, I see that I was naive. I was blinded by the swell of hope and the promise of possibility. I assumed that everything that would go wrong in our lives already had. 30 hours after crossing the border, we arrived, the three of us in the back seat of a red pickup truck that smelled of cigarette smoke and gasoline. "Wake up," I whispered, nudging Maribel as the driver turned into a parking lot. "Hmm? We're here, hija." "Where?" Maribel asked. "Delaware." She blinked at me in the dark. Arturo was sitting on the other side of us. "Is she okay?" he asked. "Don't worry," I said. "She's fine." It was just after sunset and darkness bled in from the outer reaches of the sky. A few minutes earlier, we'd been on a busy road driving through four-way intersections, past strip malls and fast food restaurants. But as we neared the apartment building, all of that had given way. The last thing I saw before we turned onto the long gravel lane that led to the parking lot was an abandoned auto body shop, its hand-painted sign on the ground propped up against the gray stucco facade. The driver parked the truck and lit another cigarette. He'd been smoking the whole trip. It gave him something to do with his mouth, I guess, since he'd made it clear from the moment he picked us up in Laredo that he wasn't interested in conversation. Arturo climbed out first, straightened his cowboy hat, and surveyed the building. Two stories, made of cinder blocks and cement, an outdoor walkway that ran the length of the second floor with metal staircases at either end, pieces of broken styrofoam in the grass, a chain-link fence along the perimeter of the lot, cracks in the asphalt. I had expected it to be nicer, something with white shutters and red bricks, something with manicured shrubs and flower boxes in the windows, the way American houses looked in movies. This was the only option Arturo's new job had given us, though, and I told myself we were lucky to have it. Silently, in the dim and unfamiliar air, we unloaded our things. plastic trash bags packed with clothes and sheets and towels, cardboard boxes filled with dishes wrapped in newspaper, a cooler crammed with bars of soap, bottles of water, cooking oil, and shampoo. During the drive, we had passed a television set on the curb, and when we saw it, the driver braked hard and backed up. "You want it?" he asked us. Arturo and I looked at each other in confusion. "The television?" Arturo asked. The driver said, "You want it, take it." Arturo said, "It's not stealing?" The driver snorted. "People throw away everything in the United States, even things that are still perfectly good." Later, when he stopped again and pointed to a discarded kitchen table, and later again at a mattress propped up like a sliding board against someone's mailbox, we understood what to do and loaded them into the truck. After we carried everything up the rusted metal staircase to our apartment, after we found the key the landlord had left for us, taped to the threshold of the door, Arturo went back down to pay the driver. He gave him half the money we had. Gone. Just like that. The driver put the bills in his pocket and flicked his cigarette out the window. "Good luck," I heard him say before he drove off.
Thank you, Christina. That's the opening passage from the Book of Unknown Americans. Do you want to talk about, we talked earlier about your process a bit with writing the book and the different narrators. How quickly in the process of your writing the book did that opening feel like the one? I mean, has that always been how you wanted to begin?
That initial paragraph that sort of sets everything up, that says, like, you know, we wanted to be well, to laugh, to eat good food, mm-hmm. you know, we believed it was our right. That was originally embedded somewhere else. And I always just really loved it. You know, when you're like, you know, as a writer, the moments you live for are those ones where you stumble upon something, you're just sort of moving along, and then you hit something and you're like, oh yes, that works. Like, that's good. Yeah. And that paragraph was one of those. I had that feeling like that was something. And so I just excised it at some point and stuck it at the beginning because it almost sort of felt like a manifesto for the whole book to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't know, can I get away with just putting it at the top like that and to see what happens? And I just left it there. And that's how that happened. It wasn't originally the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Then I wondered, it's such a strong kind of North Star for all the characters.
Exactly.
We believed this.
Yeah.
And it's such simple things
right.
that they believed in.
I think it's like hard to argue with those.
Right.
Yeah. So I put that up at the front. The rest of it, you know, I think in a first draft, you have no idea what you're doing. And then in subsequent drafts, your job is to try to figure out exactly what kind of the mission is, you know, like what's sort of coming into focus. What is your subconscious? What has your subconscious given you that now you can work with and shape in some way? And it became clear to me at some point after the first draft that part of what I was doing was trying to dismantle certain stereotypes about how we tell the story of immigrants, right? And so one of those stories that we rely on, I think, is the, like, crossing the border. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'm not going to show that. They're just going to arrive, right? We're going to skip that yeah. part and just have them show
that.
Up. Here they are yeah. at the apartment building. And so that sort of felt important to me, but it wasn't completely defined for me that that's what I was doing until later. But then it became important for me to keep it that way, you know, that you didn't actually see their journey. And in some ways, I took that idea even further because toward the end of the book, it like reverses that narrative. So you don't actually see mm-hmm. the border crossing in terms of them coming. You start to see the like a leaving. Which I thought was sort of an interesting inversion.
I think it's interesting that you were thinking about those tropes of border crossing kind of stories and things. And even the thing you were speaking about before with your anticipated reaction to the book, you were having these thoughts in the Obama administration, right?
Yes.
Which
yes. Yeah. And Obama's in the book, too. So, yeah.
I can't remember that.
They go and vote. And they're very excited to be doing that. And they're very invested in Obama and the idea of him and the idea that somebody who looks like no president in the history of the United States has ever looked might actually win, because it makes them feel, as Mayora says, you know, that they have a chance in this country too.
So it's such a pivot for our country.
Yeah.
That election.
And his mom, Celia, just thinks he's so handsome.
Right.
You know. No, and his dad's like, yeah, but he has big ears. And she's like, stop it. He's very handsome.
He's very handsome. No one can argue with that. I think one of the almost like impressionistic parts of the book for me, reflecting back on it, is the way you employ language and communication. I mean, clearly in their daily work and school lives, a lot of these characters are operating in English, but they may be speaking Spanish at home. You make that very seamless in the book, by the way, as a reader. But then there's this other language and communication element between the teenagers that it's sort of physical.
Yeah. Yeah, there is, partly because Maribel, you know, is here because she did suffer this traumatic brain injury. And so she has her own challenges with communication, and she keeps like a notebook where she writes certain things down, and she allows Mayor to read the notebook, and so that gives him certain insight, and then by extension gives the reader certain insight into her, because you know, you don't actually hear from her first person, which interestingly is, I would say, the number one most asked question by students. You know, where is Maribel's voice in the book? Which I, for a long time, had a hard time answering. And I think for me, though, she feels complete. Like, I felt as an author, like, I do hear her voice. Like, I get her. I understand her. I know her enough. And I felt also like she's powerful in the book.
Her silence is powerful.
Right. Everything that everybody does, essentially, is motivated by her.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she's the middle of this whole thing that's just, like, spinning around her. And I thought, that was, I don't know, that was enough for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's those communication issues. There's also what was interesting to me, and I took from my dad directly, was there's a scene where Mayor and his parents go to buy a used car, which has always been his dad's dream to own a car. And they're finally in a financial position where they can go buy a car. And his dad drags Mayor along with them, because to make Mayor be the one who has to speak English to the car salesman on their behalf. Yeah. Because according to his dad, there are different languages for different realms of life. You know, there's like the language of breakfast, there's the language of cars. And so he's like, even though he can speak English, Mayor's dad, he doesn't know if he knows the language of cars. And so he brings his son, who's much more Americanized than him and who's much more facile with English than him, to this car lot so that, you know, he can kind of haggle and negotiate on his behalf, I suppose.
That concept of kids speaking for their parents is such it's a powerful image.
Right. And I think a lot of students have connected with that. Because they're doing that for their parents.
Absolutely. It's been my experience. We're going to talk a little bit after the next break about the 826 Network and Youth Writing Centers. And certainly has been my experience in that network, too, with a lot of our students. Why don't we hear the Beatles next?
Okay.
Should we do that?
Sure.
Why did you choose this Beatles song?
I grew up, my dad would play the Beatles. My dad cannot exist in a house where music is not playing. And I remember listening to the Beatles so much as I was growing up. So when he came to the United States, he didn't have enough money to buy the Beatles albums, but he had another friend who had them. So then my dad dubbed them all onto cassette tapes, which I still have in his handwriting with like all the labels that are peeling off and everything, but every single Beatles album. he mostly played the White Album, which I guess is probably why to this day is still my favorite. But I don't know, the lyrics to Here Comes the Sun seem to go with the book. The book is taking place all during winter. There was that, you know, the feeling of like what's coming that's hopeful, like, you know, and so that George Harrison classic, I don't know, it's in the book, so I gave it to you too. Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
was, of course, The Beatles on The Living Writers Show here on WCBN. I'm Amanda Yulee, your host this summer, and we're speaking today to Christina Henriquez, who's the author of several books, including The Book of Unknown Americans, which we just heard a bit from earlier. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about before we move on to talk about youth writers, young writers and youth writing centers is... any components of research that you did? We were speaking earlier before the show about journalism and getting the facts right. And this is a fiction book, but clearly you must have spent some time learning and meeting people who've experienced some of these circumstances.
I did do some research. I tried my very best to do the most minimal research possible. There's a line, I think it's in The Art of Fiction, that says something like that research is not about information, it's about insight. And I think for me as a fiction writer, it isn't so much about, you know, facts and statistics and all of that sort of stuff. It's about getting me to a place in my mind where I'm close enough to understanding that then I can, like, it will set my brain on fire, you know, like it's like I just get to like the point, some kind of precipice of like, okay, now I have that insight that I need to be able to write the characters. I mean, one of the things that I really knew nothing about was traumatic brain injury. And so to include a character who had that took a decent amount of research. And I read medical texts, you know, I read certain books, all of which were somewhat helpful. But what was most helpful, interestingly, was, and I think this is sort of an underappreciated resource for writers, was YouTube.
Wow.
And so on YouTube, I somehow discovered there were all of these videos of people who had TBI, and they were just like talking, and some of them were talking about, you know, what had caused it for them or kind of what they were going through now. All of which was somewhat less interesting to me than just hearing them talk. I just kind of needed to get, you know, the cadence of their language into my head. And once I was able to do that, I felt like now I can write Maribel. You know, now I can kind of understand her enough to feel like I was getting her right on the page. Now, I mean, there's always a little bit of a fear factor when you don't know about something, you know, are you actually getting it right? But I felt I did enough research to feel like I had it for the most part. I also researched, though, the different nationalities that are represented. You know, I wanted to give them different things that made them feel authentic and
different,
like who they were.
And
it was, you know, there's this, I think, misconception of Latinos that they're all kind of this one monolithic entity, right? And I wanted to differentiate them, but I also wanted to show, for example, like how they had their own biases against each other sometimes, you know. I wanted to get some of that in there. So all of that took a certain amount of research. Beyond that, it was more just, as always is with writing, it's about paying attention to your own life and paying attention to the world around you.
How do you know when you're at that point where you have the insight without?
I think it's a gut thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's sort of a frustrating answer. But I think much of writing is that way.
You know, of course.
You're proceeding from some kind of gut instinct. And the only way that you can recognize that instinct and honor it is by practicing the craft more and more and more. So the more you do it, the better you are at being able to tell, like, oh, that is something. Oh, I'm there. I have enough information now. You know, I can back off. I can actually just sit down and write this thing, whatever it may be. It's a hard thing to teach young writers, I think. I mean, because it's sort of unteachable. And a lot of it, much to their frustration, is just about saying, like, you know, you've just got to put in the time. And the more you do it, the better you'll know what that feeling is.
Yes.
The other way to hone it, though, which is why this is the end-all, be-all advice for writing, is to read.
Yes.
right?
Keep reading.
Yeah. The more you read, the more you'll have an instinct for those kind of decisions that authors make that, you know,
that are invisible if you're not
exactly
a reader. Right. You and I first met at a dinner, a benefit dinner for 826 Chicago. And you, I know, have been involved in their work and in the work of other youth writing centers in the 826 network and beyond. So while we're talking about young writers,
yeah,
can you talk about what that work means to you and sort of what you've done?
Yeah, it's sort of a newish thing for me, but an important one for me because, you know, now I think I've gotten to a point in my career, it's not like... Like there's a boy in my daughter's class, my daughter's 12, who every time he sees me, he's like, "Are you famous? Are you famous?" I like, have to let him down easy. No, you know, but I'm like at a point at least where I feel like it's important to start thinking about or to be thinking about. And maybe I'm past that point, but giving back and what can I do, you know, since I'm not really a young writer anymore, what can I do for the writers who are coming up now behind me? Because I feel like, you know, part of the reason that I'm in a place that I am is because there were writers who came before me who opened doors. Mm-hmm. So that just on principle has been important for me to be involved with and to go into schools and to go into tutoring centers and see the faces of these kids who, like, you know, they're looking at me like I can actually tell them something. Maybe I can and maybe I can't. But I think just the presence of somebody there is so meaningful to them. And it has been meaningful to me. And I've been actually blown away. I was in L.A. a few months ago at Manual Arts High School. And they, among other things that I was doing while I was there.
826 L.A. program.
Right. And so while I was there, I met with a few students who are working on essays, and the topic was sort of songs of freedom. So they had to listen or pick a song and then based off of that song or using that song as a jumping off point, write an essay about freedom and what freedom means to them. And they were just blew my mind. I mean, they were just writing actually like really incredible stuff and were so into what they were doing that it was nice to see. Again, you know, part of my job is so solitary, and I'm not around writers a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I sort of come out, I emerge and see people. But it was nice to be reminded of that really raw impulse, you know, of early writing, and to see those students and sort of what they were up to.
I feel like we can learn so much. Every time I walk into a youth writing center, like one of the 826s, I'm learning more, I think,
yeah,
than I'm giving.
Yeah.
Just in their boldness.
Yeah.
And dedication, like you're saying, focus.
Yeah.
Which I think probably surprises me, and I think people our age, we think of young people as being less focused. But when young people focus on their writing, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my experience.
Yeah. I think it's so empowering. I think it makes them understand, hopefully, that they have a voice in the world, that people, not only that they have one, that they have one that people want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, I think those are two different things. It took me a long time to figure out that anyone wanted to hear what I had to say in terms of my writing. You know, like I didn't write about Panama for a long time because I was really convinced that no one wanted to hear those stories. I thought that those stories had no value. Partly that's because of the curriculum that I had been fed, right?
In school.
Yeah.
You weren't learning about Panama.
No. Well, I wasn't reading any writers of color. I was hardly even reading any women.
Yeah.
You know? And it just took forever for me to be convinced that that was a worthy topic.
What convinced you? What changed that?
Sandra Cisneros.
Uh-huh.
I was in
House
graduate
on
school.
Street.
Yes. But I was in graduate school.
Really?
So I...
You didn't read that in...
Way past high
fourth
school?
Fourth grade?
No.
No.
Never heard of her. Never heard of that book. I went through a Tapton University as an English major and a Spanish minor.
And you didn't read Cisneros?
Never came across my radar.
Wow.
And then in graduate school, I went to a used bookstore And I bought this anthology that was the Oxford anthology of like American short stories or something like that. And there was an excerpt from The House on Mango Street in there. And it just, it was like the whole world had been transformed for me after I read that. You know, I mean, I had been going to Panama my whole life since I was 8 months old and having all of these really rich experiences there, but never feeling like, you know, that I should write about them. Again, because of this idea that I had subconsciously built up that that A wasn't literature and B like just had no value. No one was interested, which was another way of saying though that I had no value, right? Or that at least part of me.
It's an internalized message.
Right.
Sure.
Part of me didn't have a value. And so that's what I think is like exciting when you see these kids in writing centers and in tutoring centers. It's like they're getting a distinctly different message and they're getting it way earlier than I was getting it, for example.
I'm still stuck on you didn't read her until graduate school.
I know.
I can't believe it.
Well, now I mean, I go to high schools now and I ask them, you know, if they've read it. And everyone raises their
hand. Everyone's read that.
Yeah. No.
And they should.
No. I hadn't, and like not even just hadn't read it. Had never heard of her.
We need to close the show in just a few minutes, but I, now we're talking about books. I have to ask, what are you reading now? What do you like to read generally? Like when you're writing and doing a writing project, and what can you recommend for our listeners now?
When I'm actually writing, I'm, very, I'm very selective about what I can read. And usually I get like sort of like a little nest of books that somehow is fueling directly the writing that I'm doing. And I've just revisit them over and over and over until like the novel's done. So I'll read like four books, but over and over and over for like 3 years. So that's what I've just sort of come off of that. I just finished a draft of a new book. So I haven't actually been reading a lot, but I have been accumulating books that I hope to get to soon in the meantime, which are all sitting on my nightstand. But I bought Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney. I got The Old Drift because I had read a review that Dwight Gardner did that just made it sound incredible, and I'm excited about that. I have a galley sitting on my nightstand that's very good so far called American Dirt by Janine Cummins. That should come out next year. I got Toni Morrison's book of edit essays. I think it's called The Source of Self-Regard. It has this amazing, like, pale pink cover and these, like, rose gold letters. But it had come out somewhat recently, so I got that, and it's sitting there. I have never read The Sympathizer.
Oh.
I know. And I was like, ugh.
You must.
Like, yes, yeah. I have to read that, so I bought that. So that's, like, the five or so books that are stacked up at the moment.
Yeah. You have a good stack. Yeah. Yes. Very good. Well, we're so glad that you could join us today on Living Writers, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a pleasure. We're going to close the show with the last song you chose, which is Ruben Blades.
Ruben Blades.